Hello and welcome to episode 155 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live streaming career as a radio presenter with one big regret. Never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. And on this episode of the podcast, I am joined by another hugely talented individual in the world of music, engineer, producer, mixer, editor, Fiona Cruikshank is my very special guest. One of the few people to feature on this series who is involved in more music releases each year than Mr. Weller. She's been working in studios for over a decade now. She's more in demand than ever before, even getting a well-deserved double win at the 2022 Music Producer Guild Awards for Recording Engineer of the Year and Breakthrough Producer of the Year. Her portfolio is ridiculous. We're talking film, performance arts, music, TV. Even just in the last year or so, we're talking things like Netflix, I Used to Be Famous, the award-winning Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, The Whale with Brendan Fraser, for goodness sake. She's also engineered on records by Ellie Goulding, Isabel Waller-Bridge, Johnny Depp, Jeff Beck, The Anchoress, and has collaborated with two other Weller connections who have featured on this podcast. We're talking Dot Allison and Hannah Peel, and more on that to come in this episode of the podcast. From a Weller perspective, we're going to dig into stories of engineering the strings at the magnificent Church Studios for On Sunset and Fat Pop in recent years. Two cracking number one albums. You're going to love this episode. Let's get into it. Fiona Cruikshank, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm really looking forward to this because you have done so much in such a short period of time, really, you know, creating stunning music, a massive variety of projects, like so many diverse different things that you pick up. And another one of the connections that we're talking to around Mr. Weller, who, you know, you can't pigeonhole you. You can't put you into a particular genre or a box, can you? Because there's so much that you do. Which I love.
Maybe that's maybe that's what he goes for. In collaborators.
I like it because, I mean, we're talking pop music. We will talk about Mr. Weller in a bit, obviously, but jazz, classical, rock, all of it. Have you got a favourite type of music that you like to listen to?
I mean, not really. That's why I'm so greedy in my work. The variety of it keeps it really exciting, and it also then becomes a sort of professional challenge, always working out, you know, how best to record something, or different types of mixing, from very classical straight orchestral stuff to more poppy or electronic or processed things, or, you know, I just like to challenge myself, basically.
They all take different techniques, obviously, don't they? In the recording process, it's not a one size fits all and you just plug stuff in and off you go. You have to, your studios need setting up in different ways, the production is doing in different ways, of course, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So each project is a sort of fun planning exercise, apart from anything else, talking with the client or producer, or, you know, thinking about it myself in terms of what the sort of goal sound-wise is, and then, yeah, working out your sort of technical setup from that.
Now, we'll talk about the differences in roles, because there are so many different roles that you play in the studio and have played in the studio. So many properly exciting projects, people. And we're talking about, like, the world's best producers, best engineers, best musicians that you're working with, singers, songwriters, film and TV scores. I mean, classical albums, I mentioned. There are things like Aladdin, the Grand Budapest Hotel, Beauty and the Beast. I'm just naming some of these projects so that people will realize, like, how important you are. But also Wonder Woman being another one, which, and I've heard this is a bit of a nickname of how people you describe you. Have you heard this? It feels that way.
No, I haven't.
Okay, this is something that you always wanted to do, even like as a kid. This was a world that you wanted to enter into, music production, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was really lucky because when I was a kid, I had piano lessons, and my teacher, I think we were doing like a big concert at the end of the year for all the, you know, piano pupils, and we did it live and he was recording it live, but someone was also doing sound. And I remember being really interested in the desk and what was going on there, kind of thing. And I must have been like 12 maybe. And I think he sort of spotted that and then started to sort of give me little tips here and there, little bits of info. And it grew from there, really. And then I started reading Sound on Sound and like obsessing over every sort of album cover and seeing where things were recorded and who did what. And yeah, by 13, I was like, this is it. This is what I'm doing.
Isn't that brilliant, though? Isn't that brilliant? Yeah. I mean, that was me with radio. That was the thing that I loved, and just listened to radio all the time. And I was like, got to do that. That looks like a brilliant job. I want to be Chris Evans.
Yeah.
And often you need the guidance of somebody, to like a mentor, to help you through that. And that would have been your teacher you mentioned there. Was it David Goodman? Is that right?
David Goodman. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. He was so supportive. He also plays in a band. And so one of the first things he did was to get me to sort of go to their rehearsals and help him record those rehearsals. So he had a desk and a computer setup. It was Digital Performer, though, which is I haven't been using too much since.
I've not even heard of that one, no.
Yeah, but it was a good sort of in understanding. And then he started teaching me about signal flow and acoustics and all sorts of things, really. And he was the one that spotted this sound recording university course that I ended up doing because I didn't know anyone in the industry at all. And we just couldn't see how you get from a small town to London and into a studio. You know, I just couldn't work out how I'd be able to do that. And I guess as well, my parents were a bit worried about me like wandering around the studios with my CV and as a girl. I don't know. They were quite protective, maybe.
Because it still is a very male dominated industry, but certainly like even more so over 10 years ago now. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly that. And in all these sort of magazines that I was obsessing over, I don't really remember seeing many women. And there obviously were some out there, and especially in America. But at the time, I had pictures of blokes at desks up on my walls. Like, that's the job I'm going to do.
I love that. Like, some people have like proper pinups and whatever. And like, you've got the studio engineers and
I've
producers.
Got dudes and desks.
That's wonderful. So was it University of Surrey that you went to? Was that right for the course?
Yeah. Okay. I went to the University of Surrey because they have a placement year in the industry and contacts with studios like Air and Abbey Road and the BBC. And for me, that was such a huge deal, the opportunity to make those contacts and meet people. And also because I have a classical kind of music background. I played the oboe and I sang. Most of the courses that are around at that time are more, apart from the Tom Martin, were very sort of band focused, like how to produce and record your own band, which would have been great, but I had just sort of learned the wrong instrument.
Yes.
So I went for another.
Never seen any oboes on Top of the Pops, do you? No. Glastonbury,
I went to a course and I had to do an audition on the oboe and I had to play pop or jazz. So I ended up doing like a jazz piece on the oboe. And the guys that ran the course were just like, well, we've never seen that before. I thought, maybe this isn't the place for me.
Have you ever played on anything that has been released? So when you're, or have you kind of, did you cuss off that from there and just go, that's my own private home use and that's it?
Yeah, exactly. It's really funny because sometimes my friends or colleagues do sort of encourage me to have a go. But I just haven't played in so long. I'm dreadful. The oboe is not something that sounds that nice if you're not practicing it. And I just don't have time now. I'm too busy with people that are really good at their instruments.
Yeah. It's a big old instrument that as well, isn't it?
Yeah. I think that if I played it in my flat, people might get annoyed. It's quite loud.
So let's talk about Air Studios and I want to talk about studios in generally, actually, because Paul Weller's obviously got Black Barn. You know, you've worked at Air Studios, the Church, Abbey Road. You know, we'll talk about the Church a bit more in a second as well. But
yeah,
they all have some sort of magic that makes them unique, which sounds ridiculous because they're just buildings. But that's true, right?
Oh, absolutely true. Yes. Obviously, the acoustic, also the equipment and the people, of course, make a huge difference.
What is it that makes an Abbey Road? I mean, obviously, the Beatles kind of seeps into the walls, I guess, to a certain extent, but that makes, and so you spent so long at Air Studios, like what, 10 years at Air Studios, and you still use that as a studio now. What is it that's in the DNA that makes those things so special?
When you record in Abbey, either if you're recording like an orchestra in Studio One, or especially if you're doing a band, of course, in Studio Two, as soon as a drummer starts playing, it sounds like all your favorite records and everything you've grown up on, in my case, you know. So it does have that magic of like, oh my God, that's it. That's the sound.
You are there as a fan and watching some of this stuff and just being blown away by it, I would imagine. But you've also got a job to do, obviously. So you can't get too carried away of being, you're kind of drifting off at how lovely this sound is, can you?
No, exactly. And actually, that's quite funny because I see it happen sometimes with composers that haven't been in big spaces like that before, especially. And they'll sit next to me and the take will go down and then they'll just go, wow. You're like, cool. So like any changes? And they're just like, what? You know, they're just so blown away by the whole experience and like how amazing professional musicians in London, you know, they can get, you know, 95% of the way there in the first take, in the first read. They've never seen this music before, their sight reading, and they just play it so amazingly well. And the composer's hearing this thing that they've had on samples for ages played by humans in this amazing space. And then they're just like really overwhelmed sometimes.
Yeah. I wasn't listening properly. What happened? Okay,
like, I don't know. Sorry. And I'd be like, okay, but, you know, let's do another, or can we fix this, that and the other. So yeah, I have to be a bit more less of a fangirl, but it's still very special.
It feels to me that you feel at home. All the pictures I see on Instagram are you in the studio. You know, you feel really at home. That's a kind of safe space, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny to say that. I do feel like that is my happy place. Like I am my sort of best self when I'm collaborating like that with people and making music in a studio. I mean, I like mixing as well, but it's now a more solitary act, especially since COVID. I think a lot of us work remotely and composers listen in their own rooms. And yeah, there's something so special about recording and the way that you can make changes and help and improve and produce things.
Now, I see pictures of you and it brings me back to my radio days where we used to have this massive Mark II desk when I worked at the BBC in Bristol, right? To me, it was massive. This is what I'm going to come on to, right? And I still have recurring nightmares about this bloody great desk and these knobs and these faders. And I haven't done a radio show for like 15 years doing this. And I still have these nightmares about pressing the wrong button and not queuing up things. And this was a big old desk, but my God, the things that you work on must be about at least 10 times as big as these things. I mean, they're huge.
But it's all the same, isn't it? It's just the same thing repeated loads of times.
I suppose.
Once you've got one channel, you can do 96 of them.
Yeah, there's only so that your arms only stretch so far.
That is quite funny because sometimes between takes, say someone will make a request for a change on the headphones or you'll be trying to change gains, especially at the start of the session. And, you know, the conductor will be like, right, great, here we go again. And I'm like, hang on, I can't physically get from that end to the desk to make that change to the, you know, I'm still running around. Give me a second.
Can't stretch that far.
Yeah. It does come into play sometimes.
And let's talk about the Church Studio and we'll talk about Mr. Weller in a sec, but this is somewhere you've worked quite a bit. And again, there's so many differences to these studios as well. They have something unique that's not just that DNA thing that I talked about. The church obviously is an old church, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's got that just gorgeous warmth to it. That's the only way I can explain it, really. It's a sort of medium length, you know, it's not too long a reverb, but it just kind of, I don't know, gives everything like this gorgeous tone, even on the close mics, let alone the, you know, lovely sort of perspective you can get from room mics in there.
And presumably at some point, somebody went, this would be really good to turn this into a studio or to use this as a studio space. Because it wasn't, that's not the intention, right? Initially, it wasn't designed
as
that.
No, exactly. No, and that's a good point, actually. I'd have to look it up because I think it was it the Eurythmics that turned it into a studio first? I don't know that. I should Google it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's like that thing of then the studio becomes as much a kind of part of the album. And you see this with Paul's career where, you know, he's recorded The Manor in Oxfordshire or Black Barn now, which is like Paul Weller HQ, or, you know, Solid Bond down at Marble Arch. It becomes such an important part of the mix and such an important part of these residential studios, particularly where you can kind of camp over and you're staying and spending the weeks and weeks there.
Yeah. And then they're like another band member, aren't they? As you said, they become such a part of the sonic imprint of it. You know, with Dot's album, we work a lot at a studio called Castle Sound, and I really feel like Castle Sound is part of her sound now.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because you're talking about buildings, and I hope this is coming through in terms of what we're talking about, but it is that flavour, and Paul's talked about it as well, that kind of special thing about the fact that you can go into the studio in the morning, you've got nothing, and then you're coming out at the end of it with a physical thing, which still must be so exciting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I love how sort of different the same space can be with different groups of people. I find that so fascinating.
Let's talk about some of the recordings. So I'm going to bucket these up a little bit. So film soundtracks I wanted to talk to you about first of all. I mean, honestly, the list is massive, so we're not going to go through all of them on the podcast. But things like How to Train a Dragon, Black Swan, Thor, Les Mis, Wonder Woman I mentioned, Murder on the Orient Express. These are all so different. How do they come about? How do you get? I mean, obviously, it's not the same for everything now. And now that you're a freelance versus working for Air Permanently, how would the briefs come in? How would you get assigned to a job?
In those days, I was an assistant engineer at Air. And so I would be assigned, there's a group of in-house assistants, both at Air and Abbey. And I suppose you get assigned partly on sort of the Tetris of the diary and who's free at what time. But also you get to make requests on composers that you like and people that you want to work with. And engineers that you want to work with and learn from. So with all those films, there was a bit of me going, shotgun. I want to work on that, please. You know, I'm a fan of that composer, or I like their work and I want to see how they do it.
Isn't that brilliant that's an opportunity?
Yeah, it's incredible. And so How to Train Your Dragon was in my first year at Air, and I can still so vividly remember certain days on that project and what my favourite cue was called and all that kind of thing. And it does stick with you.
And obviously this time we'll talk about COVID and the impacts of kind of recording around COVID in a bit as well, because it kind of links to Fat Pop and, you know, how Paul created that album. And, but you're there with a full orchestra in the studio on these big film soundtracks. The sound of them is so incredible, isn't it? The amount of musicians involved in these projects is huge.
Yeah, absolutely. And, there'll probably be an 80-piece orchestra, 90-piece orchestra, something like that. And quite often we now, for films especially, they need a bit more control in the final mix, and the director still wants to be able to sort of balance things. So you have to record in stem. So you might do strings on their own, and then woodwind on their own, and then brass on their own. So you see these films that are coming out now, like Mission Impossible, and they've got, you know, 100 strings, and then they've got 30 brass, and then, you know, more musicians than you could physically fit in a room at the same time. But because they're recording everything separately like that, they can have, I don't know, 40 bongos. I can't remember how many Lorne did, but it was a ridiculous amount of percussion, you know, and it's just how many people can we layer on top?
And you're building up in the mix and that. And I think that's what
you're building up in the mix.
And we'll talk about the studio roles in a bit as well, in terms of, you've covered all of those aspects of kind of from the recording to the engineering to the layering, like the mixing, everything there as well. So who were those, what were there particular highlights in terms of the people that you really wanted to work with that you then got the gig on in terms of film composers?
Yeah, when I was assisting, I'm going to upset people now, aren't I?
Should I rephrase that question?
I really wanted to work with, when I first started to air, Dario Marianelli and also Alberto Iglesias. So two European composers that I think both have like incredible relationships or did with directors. So Dario worked for a long time with Joe Wright and did Atonement and a lot of his films. And they just had such a good kind of communication. I don't know. It felt like his score was such a key part of Joe's filmmaking on those things that they did together. And I was, yeah, a big fan, both musically and just to see how that all worked. Because when I first started, I had no idea how film scoring worked and how much goes into it.
Yeah, and also, like, presumably you're not seeing, as you're creating a recording, you're not seeing the film at the same time it's being
shot. Yeah, you do.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah, so that's the nice thing now, that we are watching the picture. Don't normally get it in advance, so you watch it as you record, and therefore you see sort of chunks of it and not necessarily in the right order. You quite often see the big important scenes, so you'll go from the beginning to the end and then be like, oh, right, okay, spoiler. But that's how you sort of help the composer to produce their score, because you're watching it down and thinking, oh, okay, actually that brass seems too loud now. It, you know, makes you feel the wrong thing as we're watching it. So let's get them to play quiet, or, you know, everything you're doing is reacting emotionally to picture sort of as you're working.
Wow. What an amazing process. That's incredible.
Yeah. Which is really cool. So you, yeah, getting to the mix and seeing how it all fits together. We always mix as well with dialogue and effects. So the idea is that I mix the music first, and then I bring in the dialogue and effects and make sure that it works underneath it and kind of balance things, so that when they get to the final mix in the dub, they don't have to do a whole lot of work to make a thing play. You know what I mean? They can just slot it in and hopefully listen, and they will, of course, ride it and everything, but there's nothing that's going to stick out or annoy anyone, hopefully, too much.
Wow, what an amazing process. I love that. So Dario, you mentioned there, was it Anna Karenina? Was that the first one?
Yeah, Anna Karenina. Yes, yeah.
Which I think Hannah Peel is part of that soundtrack. I don't know if you know this, being a
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, she's part of that soundtrack as well. So you have to go back and find those stems and see if you can find Hannah.
That's amazing. It's so nice how these things happen, like before you meet.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about Hannah in a second, because obviously, you know, huge, big key thing. But let me talk about, and we'll come back to the studio roles, but let me talk about, you mentioned Dot Allison. So we've got this here.
Oh, check it out.
Heart-Shaped Scars, which is on, I'm just going to check. I think it's this beautiful green. Yeah, it is the green vinyl. Look at that.
Oh, you got the green one. Lovely.
Beautiful, beautiful. What a lovely album. Dot's been on the podcast. And this was, even though Hannah Peel was involved in this album, and Hannah had been involved in Mr. Weller and True Meanings and all that by this point, your work with Dot was pre-Paul Weller. So when you worked with Dot, you hadn't yet worked with Paul.
No, what order was it? Maybe I started with Dot, because that album was another COVID, you know, it stretched over a long time because COVID happened in between. Because I met Hannah first on with Paul. And then when Dot was looking for arrangers, I was like, Hannah Peel. And she was like, oh, Paul has also suggested Hannah, surprisingly. And then we all came together, kind of thing.
Cool. Okay. Well, let's talk about these three albums. So I've got here Dot's album, we'll talk On Sunset, and we'll talk Fat Pop. Okay. So I mentioned to Dot that you were coming on the podcast, and she said, I'll read this to you. She said, how lovely. Fee is a legend in all ways. Amazing what she does. And a very, very lovely human to be with any moment that is a pressure cooker studio situation. I love Fee, she said.
That's so nice, isn't it?
And I asked how you got to work together, and she said it was a recommendation from a mutual friend.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'll read the rest of it too, because it's nice. It's always nice to hear how people think about you, right? She said, they thought she was one of the best engineer mixers, and at that point, I only knew Fee as a recording engineer and mixer, but I asked her if she'd be up for co-producing with me too on Scars. She said yes. Then we hit it off, and I sent a few links of music as a sort of sonic mood board with the kind of sonic image I like, and we shared that vision, which was great. You're getting this brief, you're getting this, and you're just finding that you have a connection, I guess, as people who love music create music.
Yeah, exactly. And that it's one of those tricky things, because the word producer means so many different things, right? And I was like, what kind of producer do you want? Do you want someone that's going to help with the sonic palette and kind of getting the sound you want? And for us, it was all about warmth and space, and Dot and I both loved like that acoustic thing. And or do you want a producer that like programs beats and writes lines on synths, and you know, that's not me. So there's always that conversation at the first go, what type of producer are you looking for? Am I the right?
Or some producers are like, they're the ones telling you to get this shit done and get it on time. You know, cracking the whip in a way as well, aren't they? So is it that type of producer?
Yeah. And Dot's sort of lucky, special, I don't know what the word is, in that she's able to run that herself, to decide when she wants things done. And then, so that's nice. I mean, I like having a deadline, but I never have to be the one with her saying, you've got to get this done now, because we create those deadlines ourselves.
And it's such a wonderful, I mean, it could only be Dot Allison, the album. It's such a wonderful, unique sound. And that is that sonic palette, the you know, the acoustics and where she's gone and recorded these field recordings and turned them into music. And it's a lovely comeback LP, wasn't it? But have you known much about her before that point then?
Not really. I'd heard, you know, a couple of things with One Dove. And then I sort of, had to do a deep dive when we first were connected. Because she hadn't been working for 10 years, you know, and
Let's talk Paul Weller. Presumably a fan before you got to work with him, were you?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I think Paul is possibly the only person that has ever impressed my family.
Because in my dad's a big fan. In any way, shape, or form, any part of life.
Yeah, so ever. Exactly that. It's just, you know, like, Dad, guess what? I'm working with Weller. And he was like, oh my God, you know, finally something that has enough kudos.
Oh, what, the CV hadn't been impressive enough to...
Yeah, to pique my parents' interest, because they're normally just like, oh, that's nice. oh, do you like that person? Oh, good, okay. You know, but then this was one that was like, whoa, really? You know. So just, thank you, Paul.
That is so brilliant. So tell me how this came about. Presumably it was an intro from Hannah Peel, some kind of connection there, I would guess.
No, so that's the funny thing, because we hadn't met at that point, and it was the church. It was the wonderful people at the church who got me in on this. I think the gig had come to them, and I had done some string stuff there before that point and really enjoyed it. I guess, obviously, I'm just at home in churches, you know. In churches and on Neve desks, you know, happy. So I'd really got on with everyone there and really enjoyed it. And I think I'd made some good recordings. And their in-house engineer at the time was maybe not so confident on strings or orchestral stuff. And so when the job came in, they called me and said, would you be interested in this? We'll introduce you to Paul's producer and you can have a chat and see if you get on. And, you know, and so that's how it came about.
Right. Okay. Wow. So the studio first. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because he's got his own studio, obviously. I mean, not big enough for a big old string section and stuff, but there are other studios. So do you know why he picked the church?
I don't. I mean, it is such a good size for that size of orchestra. And also they wanted a sort of big cinematic sound. They also wanted a sort of retro vibe, and they wanted the choice to be tight if they needed to be, you know, in sort of how you recorded it, closeness, but also room and space. And have options. And so for that, I think it is an amazing choice of room.
So this is On Sunset. This is the album came out 2020, came out during COVID, although not recorded during COVID. Yes. And string arrangements from Hannah, like we mentioned. So you as engineer, and let's talk about these differences in roles. And we've talked about you co-producing with Dot Allison. We mentioned Keaton Henson. Engineering is a very different technique, obviously, very different skills that you're using in a way. So what was the job? What did you have to do to make that work?
So in this instance, it was Stan saying, the sound we would like is this. We want retro. We want lush. We want cinematic kind of thing. And so then my role was to go, okay, which microphones would I choose to give them that sound? And having room options and then close mics and putting up ribbons to kind of get a more warmth and an old school kind of vibe. And then using the plate, the church. So my role then was sort of like more technical, creative. I had no involvement in the songs, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And how are you doing that? Just obviously there's bags of experience now. Are you testing things? And so like when you say about the ribbons and stuff, are you testing things going, okay, no, that doesn't quite work. That works. Or is it just that you know that space so well, yeah, you know what's going to work? Or
yeah, exactly. I guess it's the experience of the mics, knowing what they sound like and how they will work together, you know. So it's kind of like EQing with microphones. Quite often I'll put out some ribbons and something a lot brighter, and then you can fade between them to get the amount of warmth that you want or the amount of sort of definition. And it's experience with the mics and then knowing that space, but also instinct, I guess.
And how much are you having to get there in advance from Mr. Weller and Stan and all that and the orchestra to set all this up?
Probably 3 or 4 hours. So we set it up, plug it in, build our Pro Tools template, and then do a line check and make sure everything's working. And you put the mics off. And this is the funny thing as well in orchestral sessions, the musicians are on the clock and it's very strict. They're unionized. So they have a 3-hour session, say, with a 15-minute break. And then as soon as that second hand goes, they're out of there. You don't have a lot of time to mess about or to experiment. So you kind of have to do your best guess. And then you have maybe tops 3 or 4 minutes for tweaking. And then you're off.
Bloody hell.
The experience of obviously having assisted at air, watched lots of people do it in lots of different ways. And then myself starting to engineer, trying different things and learning and then getting a good sort of gut instinct for it, because you've not, I did hear demos, but you don't know quite how it's going to sound in the room until it happens to you. So
isn't it brilliant though, that we're this far into creating music as human beings and studio music, recorded music, you know, what's that 60 plus years now in terms of popular music, if you like. But they were still finding new ways to do it, and we're still testing and learning and all that kind of stuff. Isn't that remarkable?
Yeah, exactly. That's what's so exciting. There isn't a one size fits all, or to me, there isn't. I love that, you know, the changing it every time and making it specific to that project is what makes it really exciting.
Yeah, and there's no like right or wrong. People can't tell you, no, that's not how you, yeah. We always do it like this. Like, no, we don't. I love that. It's so fascinating, isn't it? So this is Para Orchestra as well. And they've been mentioned on the podcast before. In fact, Hannah created a number one classical album with them in after this project as well. And then this amazing integrated orchestra of professional, disabled, non-disabled musicians. And I think I'm right in saying it's the first orchestra of its kind in the UK. A different orchestra to work with. Obviously, there are different challenges, I would guess, in that setup.
Yeah, I suppose you just have to be mindful of where people might need something extra, like maybe a bit more light if they're partially sighted, or different headphone feeds so that they can have things a bit louder than other people, you know, like everyone records to clicks, say, and if they are maybe hearing impaired and the click's not loud enough, but then for everyone else it would be painful, you know. So it's that sort of thing, just being able to set up maybe a couple of things that can help people.
When we look at the album credits, and let me grab On Sunset, because this is such a beautiful thing, and you get this and you see your credit in there, and there's mention, which must always be a buzz, right? Must always be a kick. But you see the name, and then you don't know the amount of work that's going into creating these fabulous sounds. It's fascinating, this. I love it. Can we talk about a few of the tracks? I don't know where how much you remember about the specific tracks, but there's a song called Village, which I absolutely love. This is Mick Talbot on Hammond organ, Ben Cordelia from Weller's Band on drums and percussion. And obviously they're not there with you at this moment in time, are they? This all gets layered up later on, right? What are your memories of the creation of that track?
Well, I think actually that we're normally one of the last things in the process, as in they've recorded the band already. So I've got sort of stems of those guys and they're playing and we're fitting around them, which means that there's you know, more room to sort of shape the strings to make sure that they work in the track and with the vocal and around all the other stuff. Not, they haven't mixed it yet, so obviously they can make changes again afterwards, but it's, yeah, trying to make it all work in together. Oh, I can't remember how many tracks we did in a 3-hour session. Was it 4? But that's the other thing. For us, it's quite quick to get through a song like that. You maybe have 40 minutes to an hour. So in terms of sort of specifics, I don't really remember what we said about that track, but I remember sitting there with Stan and Paul, and Hannah obviously was conducting the orchestra, and they'd do a take, and then we'd all make comments on how it could be played differently, or dynamics, or different sort of techniques, and how, yeah, how to fit around that guitar line, or, you know, could we put that up the octave so that it cuts through that sort of bassy thing, or, you know, those are the sort of chats that you have.
But presumably they're not playing along with the track, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. So,
oh, they are.
Yes,
okay.
They are. Yeah. So while we're recording, we are listening, and everyone's on headphones and they're listening to the track, as well as a bit of click just to help keep them in time, and then themselves. It's hard with those headphones, and especially string players usually monitor on just a single-sided headphone because their instrument is under their other ear, if you can imagine. So it's really hard to get all of that information about where you fit into a track on one ear, but they do have a bit of the picture. And then we quite often do playbacks on the speakers so that everyone understands, you know, what they're kind of aiming for.
What a thrilling experience. Honestly, this is incredible. And the thing is, we talked about you as a producer, here's you as an engineer, but Paul certainly in recent years has been self-producing more, working really closely with Stan as well, but he knows what he wants, I guess.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And so I guess the first time we worked together, having had this big chat on sound before and everything, and me being a fan obviously as well, and then, you know, he's sitting there listening intently, arms folded on the desk, and I'm just like, oh gosh, what's he gonna, there's that fear after the first take of, you know, are they gonna like this? And what am I going to do if they don't?
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, oh, God.
I don't like the microphones. Yeah. You're like, oh.
Yeah. You're just like, I don't like the sound, you know. And I think he just turned around and went, it's great, Fee. Like, and put his thumb up, you know. I was just like, whew, okay. Great. Good. Because I was like, you've got these options, and we've done this, that, and the other. And, you know, trying to talk to them. Stan's just like, this is great. We could just use your live mix, as in we'd found everything that we'd. And that's why having these conversations in advance is so important, I guess, to really understand what's in someone's head. But thankfully, yeah, they were happy, I guess. And that's why we got to do it again.
Yeah. When we talk about Fat Pop in a sec. So there are four tracks, you're right. Village on Sunset, so the title track, yeah, which also has the Staves on backing vocals. And I know that you're a big fan of them, but I'm guessing they weren't there, obviously,
Staves.
Right?
No, sadly not. Can you imagine?
Oh,
they should have done it live with the strings. That would have been great.
Yeah, wouldn't that have been good? Earthbeat was another one where we also have Staves again, but we also have Coltrane, and then Rockets, which is just an absolutely stunning album closer, yeah. I think, if I'm right. Is that the album finish? Yeah, it's the last track on the album, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there was an additional string arrangement from Andy Crofts on that. So I'm not sure if Andy was involved in the session down with you guys, or whether it was just Hannah conducting on that one.
I think it was just Hannah, but I confess.
Okay.
It blurs.
But also, isn't it remarkable that here we are, we're talking about Mr. Weller. This is a 30 plus year solo career. It's now, what, 40, I'm trying to do the maths quickly in my head, something like 45 years plus overall from the beginning of the Jam and all that. And here we are with this on Sunset, and it's the number one album, and it's a remarkable piece of work. I mean, it's one of my favourite Weller albums. It's terrific.
Yeah. The whole thing is just so gorgeous, isn't it? I love the sound of it. My part was only a tiny bit in that, if you know what I mean. I'm not saying I love the sound that they have created, and then to get to put like a tiny bit of sprinkle on top is like such a dream.
What did your folks say when the album came out? Did they ever listen? Is it one in their collection, and were they like?
Yeah, definitely. And I think just like with everyone, they're just like, oh my God, you know, A, he still sounds amazing. He's still writing great songs. Like, it's incredible, isn't it? And he is the nicest man. I mean, I'm sure everyone says this.
Well, yeah, I've yet to find anybody on the podcast who said that he's an arse, which is disappointing, really, because you need a bit of balance. I mean, if this was the BBC, we'd have no balance whatsoever on this, you know.
But, you know, not everyone has to be, especially if you're brought in just as an engineer for the day, like me. I don't expect anyone to be overly friendly, or, you know, it's like professional and then goodbye and thanks for it. He was just sort of like, we're going for lunch over the road, Fee. Do you want to come for a cup of tea? Or, you know, we all went and had, and I actually, like, I stayed and packed up the mics with the assistants kind of thing. And then when I finished, I left the church and they were still in the cafe opposite. And he was like, Fee, come over, you know, just like went and had a sit down. And then there are people walking past that are like, sorry, are you Paul Weller? Can we have a photo? And he's just like, yeah, sure. You know, it's just like such a nice man. As well as talented. It's not fair, really, is it?
That is annoying, isn't it? Right, let's talk Fat Pop. So here we are, another number one album. This is on orange vinyl. What a beautiful thing this is.
Oh, wow.
I love this.
I don't have the vinyl of that one.
Oh, look at that.
Gorgeous.
Look at that.
Nice.
Terrific. But this is a different thing entirely, because the idea was On Sunset would come out, Mr. Weller would do a massive tour, as he usually does on Sunset, mm-hmm. and then at some point we'd move on to the next album. Obviously, COVID hit, and presumably in your world, you mentioned about kind of, you know, getting people in a studio and recording, or in the church or air studios, whatever, recording these big orchestras and things. Suddenly, and at that point, you'd gone freelance as well, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So your entire world is this, and then suddenly that world just almost stops or changes completely overnight in terms of how you can get people together, social distancing, recording, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, I mean, obviously it's so weird for everyone, but going from sort of assistant air, where you do a lot of hours, assistant at any studio, you can imagine, you're working weekends, you're working nights, you're working a lot of hours. And then I went freelance and obviously kind of pushed to get myself going. And then all of a sudden, the bottom fell away from all of us, didn't it? And you're like, I've never not worked for this long before. It was really weird. But we were super lucky, because I guess it was June that year when studios opened up again with very strict social distancing and limits on capacity and, you know, all these new rules that the big studios kind of had to agree with the EMU, kind of make up. And we're right. very lucky for all the people that did that and were involved in those conversations, you know, but it enabled us to reopen for recording, because it's not something you can do at home.
Yes.
Thank goodness.
You're having to write the rules together of liaise with the government or the union to go, this is
yes,
what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Right?
And the government to say, yeah, how can we do this? How can we do this safely? And we came up, you know, with the sort of originally 2 or 3 meter distancing that reduced over, you know, months and months as COVID changed, only being allowed, say, 3 people in the control room. So most clients were listening in on audio movers and communicating via Zoom, and a very strict cleaning down of everything at the end of the night. And then these UV cleaners that were installed in all the studio, you know, it was crazy, actually, that was not that long ago. So yes, then Fat Pop was done in a socially distanced way. And it was like learning again how to record, because especially for orchestral recording, you used to rely a lot on your room mics having a good image, because the kind of players are all gathered around this central point. And now they're all massively spread out. So everything becomes more roomy, less defined. There were at first sort of issues with players tuning to each other because they were sat physically so far apart, or timing, because you might be so far away from someone else that you can't lock in like you normally do as a unit. So it was weird.
And presumably there are occasions where you can't get that many people in the room that you would normally, like the actual full orchestra in the room as well.
Yes. And that became the thing. You were limited on amount of humans that you could have, regardless of budget, you know.
Goodness
me. It was like, how many people can you fit at a 2.5 meter distance?
And how are you? Are you marking it out with sticky tape of where people can stand in that?
Yeah, we literally were there with the measuring tape, and we got sort of plans. So for this, we got a floor plan from the church. And then I worked with the orchestra kind of manager to work out where everyone could sit and, you know, measured it out to scale. And we made, you know, suggestions of like, okay, well, if we put this person here and think we can fit that many violas in like this, you know. So there was a lot of back and forth beforehand. And then mics wise, you end up doing it differently, as I say, because basically I use more mics, more close mics, to kind of counter the fact that everyone was really far apart and the room mics wouldn't be quite so useful. And you needed more like a mid pickup to kind of reach the people at the back that normally you'd be able to hear clearly on the rooms and that kind of thing. So.
Yeah, the difference of them being packed together and spaced out in terms of the sound.
And then really
the
spaced out.
Yeah.
I mean, it was kind of lovely in lots of ways. And there were some projects that we did over that time that people were like, oh, I actually prefer this. But the musicians didn't like it.
Yeah.
No. They didn't. Yeah. They wanted to be packed, you know, with it.
Now, this album, so Paul, like I say, On Sunset, the tour and all that gets cancelled. Paul immediately, his reaction is to just go back into writing
music.
Write the music. It's what he does.
Yeah.
So another album comes around. And so he was like sending little bits to his band members. They were sending bits back remotely and stuff. But there obviously becomes a window of opportunity where you can get into the studio and do this. So this is between lockdown, like proper lockdowns, presumably.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. When things are back open, but yeah, still socially distanced, as I say.
And what's it like on Sunset, where most of the tracks have pretty much fully formed, or, you know, that you're aware of how the song's going to go and you're layering on top again?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm sure there were sort of adjustments afterwards, but you had a really good base for what the track's going to be and how we're going to fit into it.
And again, Hannah Peel involved. So, I mean, you obviously did something right on the first time, Power Orchestra, the orchestra, yeah. Again. And there are three tracks. And again, you might not remember the specifics about the tracks, but I want to mention them because they are lovely. There's a song called Glad Times, which is Tom Doyle, who created the track with Paul. He arranged the strings with Hannah, actually, been on the podcast. I should also mention Ants as part of that as well. They're called White Label. You should check out their new album. I should say that as well. It's brilliant. Back to the Fat Pop album, there's another song that you worked on called That Pleasure, which is the reaction to Black Lives Matter, the death of George Floyd. And then a lovely song called Still Glides the Stream, which was created with Mr. Craddock, Steve Craddock. Were any of these people in the studio again with you, or is it just you, Stan, Weller and Hannah?
No, and that is the unfortunate thing again, because actually of COVID in that. Well, there's two things actually about the church. One is that you are in the same room as the musicians. So there isn't a separate control room at the church. Ah. The desk is in the main room. And so everyone has to listen while the takes are going down on headphones. And also, you can't move or chat or blow your nose or even squeak your chair because everyone will hear you. And so the sad thing about that is that you do kind of say, well, we can't have too many people come down and hang out because there isn't the room, and also it'll be noisy. But in COVID times, it was even worse because it was like you're only allowed the minimum amount of people to come and listen, which is a shame.
Because a part of the creation of an album with bands and all that is the bands, and it's the yeah. camaraderie and all that, right?
Yeah. And I'm sure if it's not something you see every day, especially, like, they would have loved to come and hang and see it. But for us, it felt like the gang was back together. It was such a nice day, just seeing everyone. And again, I remember Paul coming in and just going for a big hug. And at that time, everyone was being weird about, you know, elbows and...
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just like, oh, you're hugging. Good. And he was like, oh, sorry, I should have checked. Ah, it's a minefield now, you know.
Yeah. We were all like, nobody's hugged me for 6 months.
Yeah, exactly. But like seeing everyone again was like going back to school. I don't know. It was just such a nice, like, yay, Hannah's here and Stan's here. You know, we're all together. Let's do this. Like, we know where we are. We know what we're doing. And everyone's relaxed and knows their role. And it's just like so lovely. And obviously great, great music. So.
What was the vibe in terms of the sound this time around? Was it different in terms of what they wanted from you? Because you mentioned the kind of brief last time and how that, the expectation of the sound. Obviously, you're playing with COVID as well, but the sound of the album is an evolution. It's a step on again. Every track is so different in terms of the sound of it, isn't it? So what was the ask from you?
Yeah, I think that I just tried to give them different options, really, things that they could play with in the mix. As I say, being able to get a kind of really close sound if they wanted to, or being able to go more classical. You know, I remember Still Glides thinking, oh, it'd be lovely being more roomy and like with reverbs and delays. And, you know, I'm always trying to predict what someone will want to do in the mix and what they'll need. And quite often that translates as options.
Yeah. Give them lots of things. Yeah. A lot of people have talked about Mr. Weller and this ability to hear things that maybe other artists can't and don't mention. These kind of, was it somebody talks about brushstrokes on an album? The little additions of small things that layer it up and layer it up and layer it up.
Oh, yeah. Did Dot say that?
I think she said it. A few people have said it. Yeah.
Yeah. We're always talking about this sort of like sonic painting. And sometimes it's like slowly layering up. And sometimes Dot's like, throw everything at it and then we scrape it away. It's like a different, you know, go at it from a different angle of like, we're trying everything and then we're scraping away and shaping it like sculpting.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because it's also, I guess this is true of any piece of creativity, but there's an element where in a multiverse, there are alternative versions of all those tracks there where you scraped away less or you added more or whatever.
Absolutely.
But we never get to hear those, but you lot all get to hear those, which is really bloody annoying. Damn you. I should say Fat Pop was also number one, right? So congratulations to all of you for that. That was a fabulous
thing. It's amazing.
Now, I've heard that Mr. Weller is working on a triple album now, but this was like a little interview he did in one of the magazines. He said that's what's next. One of the few things he hasn't properly done is like a triple studio album. Have you had any connection on what's coming next? Have you connected with Mr. Weller on anything since?
No, not yet. And I have to say that is quite standard for me, that things are quite last minute. Just generally. Yeah. So I wouldn't expect to, of course.
Well, also, like you say, it's like your bit is coming at the end when a lot of the tracks are, you're adding those layers later on.
Exactly. Because for Hannah or whoever's doing the arrangements, it's so important to have the track down and especially the vocal to understand, you know, what you're working around and balancing against. Hannah's so brilliant at kind of finding these little melodic things in the melody that not necessarily like exactly the hook, but she'll find a little thing that he's done and then weave that into the string, you know, all that kind of thing. And so that's only possible, of course, if the track's pretty much there.
Yeah. And I guess also getting that many people together in a room, the orchestra, is, that's not a cheap thing. So you don't want to do it track by track as you go through 2 years making an album, do you?
No, exactly. It's always, right, we're ready now. We do all the strings on one day.
And obviously we'll keep an ear out for whatever comes next from Mr. Weller in that regard. And hopefully you and Hannah will be involved. I mean, Hannah, I saw her live the other week. Absolutely fantastic. Such a talent. And the two of you, I mean, you're so productive. The amount of projects you have, all these plates spinning at the same time, is incredible.
Me and Hannah are always like, just make sure I have a break. Like, we're always telling each other off. And then not doing it ourselves.
Now, I mentioned we'd talk about roles, studio roles, right? So yes. I'm going to talk through some of the things. And I'm going to put these in the show notes of the podcast because I want people to look these things up as well, right? So there is you as a producer, engineer, and mixer. So we're talking about albums like Keaton Henson, who we're going to come back to in a sec. And Dot Allison, I mentioned earlier on as well, has been on the podcast, another fabulous talent, co-produced her album, Heart-Shaped Scars. And actually this coming Friday, brand new album released, Consciousology. Also Hannah Peel involved in that one, and you're involved in that one again as co-producer, right? Then we have you as a score engineer and mixer. So things like Phantom of the Opera, The Boy, The Mole, The Fox and The Horse as well, which we should mention because the cartoon, like, was this Christmas just gone? I'm trying to remember now, but won an Oscar as well, didn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Amazing.
So what's your role on as a score engineer? Talk me through what your role and mixer, the difference between working with Weller on that Fat Pot on Sunset projects and doing that job.
I suppose the difference is that quite often with film stuff, I am booked directly by the composer or the artist, which I am in the pop world as well. But so they come to me and say, do you want to record this with me? They describe the sort of sound they want. I suppose like they're producing it as well as composing it. And then you kind of co-produce it, but that there isn't, that title isn't often used in film.
Is it not? Okay.
Interestingly, I don't know why. Yes. So then I'm in charge of deciding how to record it and actually engineering it on the day and then probably mixing it as well, usually in surround. And then the music gets sent off to the final mix and it's mixed in with the dialogue and effects.
Of course, because, yeah, again, the sound and what we hear is different. Although Mr. Weller has dabbled a bit with 5.1 and the stereo sound on but that's not a thing really on most albums these days, although becoming more so with like Atmos and things like that. But, you know, for creating for film, you're obviously creating for that whole experience of being in a cinema, aren't you?
Exactly that, yeah. So you're always thinking in surround rather than stereo.
That's not something you can do at home. Well, yeah, you were. You were editing these things at home sometimes during COVID. So how are you doing that type of thing at home?
Well, yes, I have my own surround mix studio. I edit at home because I'll do that on headphones or on stereo speakers and then kind of mix it in surround. So score editing is slightly different again in that usually someone else is mixing it. And I'm bringing recordings from, so let's say like The Little Mermaid. We've got recordings of like the orchestra from Air. And then we've got a band that was recorded at British Grove. And we've got steel pans that we did in another room. And we've got the actors singing. And so it's like lots of different elements from lots of different places. All of them playing to click. But when you actually go through, not necessarily quite locked in. And you don't want to make it sound too sort of on the grid and metronomic. You want to sort of pick some, like the bass of the band, as in bass, drums, guitars, or whatever it may be, to be the sort of basis and the groove of the track, and then make sure that everything else works with them. So then that's sort of like preparing it and making it sound as groovy and as good as it can do before the mix.
Right. I was going to ask you about, that was one of the things I was going to ask you about, the score editing side of things, because Mary Poppins Returns was another one, and getting to work with people like Mark Shaiman, for goodness sake. I mean,
who is just incredible. And again, so lovely. Yeah, it's amazing because that process means sort of quite often sitting with a composer and him going, I don't like that vocal take, or I don't like that thing that they did. And he'll often be explaining to me as well with orchestral takes, have you got another one where you can hear more of the bassoon there? And he'll sort of point at the picture and go, look, it's hitting the little dog running, you know, and you get all these sort of lessons in how their brain works.
And I find that so fascinating about creatives generally, whether it's a musician, a singer, songwriter, people like Paul or a filmmaker, they are coming at life from just a different angle, aren't they?
Yeah. In film, everything is, of course, trying to make brilliant music, but it's also all about how it supports the image and how it makes you feel in relation to that. So of course, everything's about feeling, but you know, so much more instinctive. Like, am I feeling what the character's feeling? Is it doing that job? Is it leading me in that direction?
And such a collaborative process, it has to be, because the director's not able, so most directors are not able to compose their own music in their own films and things like that, are they?
Yeah, so. Exactly. So directors and producers come to the sessions as well. And we'll sort of say, oh, that's quite good, but I want it to be more scary when this thing happens, or, you know, I want to feel this moment more. And then the composer will be making changes, or I might make some suggestions that the musicians can change something to have that impact.
Now, I've got to ask you before we go what you're working on at the moment, because you are busier than ever. Is there anything you can tell us about that isn't embargoed or isn't kind of undercover on what you're up to right now?
It's a good question. I'm working on a couple of series for Disney Plus. It's okay if I don't know if I can say what they are.
No, that's fair enough. But let me watch your expression as I mention some of these possibilities. Maybe Marvel, no, Star Wars. No, okay, we'll continue.
It's not that one, actually. They're both sort of family action adventure things, and they're really good fun and quite different. And I've also just done a film for Netflix and a computer game, and I'm definitely not allowed to tell you which one.
A computer? Is that first?
I've been working on a couple of games recently that haven't come out yet, and they're very much NDA'd. There'll come a time when you'll see me shouting about computer games all of a sudden.
Presumably that's an entirely different process again in terms of how you work with the creators of those things, yeah?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, there's just so much music, and a lot of it needs to be able to loop and layer and work together, and that process, how they work out, how it's all going to fit together, just blows my mind. And it's like 4 hours of gameplay or something, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, and you need to then not get bored of the song, the tune, the music being played, right?
Yeah.
It's like, it's coming around that often.
Exactly that. It needs to be sort of repetitive enough, but not boring. So it's really, it's a hard balance.
Well, I look forward to that being added to your ridiculously impressive CV, Fiona, honestly. And it must be, I mean, getting the, you know, seeing these things come out, and then, because it takes a long time to make a movie and an album often, and things, well, not in Paul's case with an album probably, but yeah, some of these projects are like years in the making. So when you suddenly see a Little Mermaid going live in the world and getting the reaction that it did, and those albums going live, and that must be so rewarding.
It's amazing. I mean, Mermaid, I went to see with a friend and their kids. And it was the loveliest thing to see them reacting to it, you know, made me very emotional. And similarly, when an album comes out, you mentioned Keaton Henson, and he's a great friend of mine. And when his album finally, you know, the pride and the joy for them, for Dot and for Keaton, whoever's baby it is, you know, you feel like, oh, I've helped them get their music out there in the world. And it's a great feeling.
Well, I know, again, I mean, I've got no talent in that space whatsoever, but so I'm always in awe that anybody goes into a studio with nothing in the morning, like I say, maybe some lyrics, or, you know, and then at the end of it, we get this thing and we can listen to it, and it lives on forever. You know, those things are in the world forever.
How cool is that?
It's very cool. I mean, what a cool gig you have. I should mention, I mean, when I talk about recognition, it must have been lovely to get the recent awards as well. So we had the Music Tech Awards last year, Engineer of the Year. We had this well-deserved double win, Music Producer Guild Awards for Recording Engineer of the Year and Breakthrough Producer of the Year.
Oh my gosh, that was just absolutely bonkers, I think. I just couldn't believe it. And actually, the actual physical awards arrived this year, as in like the week of this year's awards.
Oh, right.
So I didn't have the physical thing for like a whole year. And I was like, maybe that was just a dream. That was just like this crazy night where lovely things happened. And then the physical awards, I'm like, this actually happened. I can't believe it.
You're like, they didn't follow it up. Yeah. I don't know whether I won that thing or not.
yeah. Maybe that. Well, I just dreamt that. It's not true. But it was so lovely. And especially because it really feels like, since going freelance, when you're an assistant at a studio, you're part of that family. You know, the air gang was so tight. And then you go out on your own and you're like, this is really scary. Now am I in sort of competition or what? Because I'm not very good at that. But then to find that actually we're in this lovely, supportive community where we're all sort of appreciating each other's work and bigging each other up, and, you know, an awards thing like that, which is nominated for by your peers, is, very special.
And I mentioned at the beginning how, like, 10, 12 years ago when you first started, it was such a male-dominated industry. Do you feel that has changed for the better? I mean, it's not It's not where it needs to be, but it is getting better, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly even in the last 5 years, let's say. Because when I first started, there were a few people ahead of me, but it was still very, very unusual. And now there's really cool things happening.
Talking of which, tell me about this special issue that's coming up of Sound on Sound magazine. This sounds brilliant.
Sound on Sound are doing an issue coming up where all the articles are written by women, producers and engineers. And there's going to be a lot of sort of gear reviews and also, I guess, stories about their work and how they got into the industry and that kind of thing. So it's really exciting.
Oh, brilliant. Wow.
We sort of had a massive photo shoot at RAC the other day, and Catherine Marks is heading it up, incredible producer. And just being surrounded by the women and knowing that all of us are kind of, we're doing it. We're doing this job. It is possible to do this job. We're all here. You know, it was such a good vibe. It was really incredible and inspiring. And yeah.
I love the idea. You know what I love about that most is the idea that somewhere there'll be a 13, 14 year old kid buying that magazine.
Exactly.
Cutting out those and sticking them on their bedroom wall, right?
I was that 13 year old kid. And the thought of seeing, you know, all these badass women in that issue is just like, it's so exciting to me. That's going to exist.
Well, this has been honestly such an absolute delight chatting to you. I have two final questions for you before you go.
Yes. Okay.
So you're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council or Solo. What would you go with?
You Do Something to Me.
Ah, why that one?
I just, even talking about it, it like makes my whole body go. I just think it's like such magic. And as soon as I hear it, I melt.
Your face changed completely when I asked you why. You were like,
it makes me emotional just thinking about it. It's like, oh, yeah.
What did you think? Because there was obviously...
Sorry, is that a lame answer? Does everyone say
that's a great answer. Just your reaction was wonderful. It was obviously, it would have been, when would it have been? The round, he did the gig at the Barbican, didn't he? And they did with Jules Buckley, and they did that with strings and stuff, but which was just beautiful, right?
Yeah, I'm such a fan of Jules, and I watched that concert in, it all. And it's just, it's sort of like, oof. It does something to me.
She's gone, folks. We need to wrap up. She's gone. I tell you. Final question. So the purpose of this podcast is to meet lovely people like yourself who've had these connections with Paul, to hear your stories and your connections, but to hear all about you, really. But I've got to be honest, the reason I created the podcast was for me to get an interview with Paul Weller that I never managed during my radio career. But that was my one big regret. I never got to interview Weller. So I created a podcast to make it happen. We're now on episode 155. And it still hasn't happened, but, you know, one day. So if it happens, what should I ask him? What would you like to know?
Oh, God, that's tricky, isn't it? Okay. I would like to know what, if he could play any instrument that he can't play now, what would it be?
That's a great question.
Pick, you know, any instrument. Like, if you could play any instrument, what would you play?
Oh, well, I'd play the guitar because that's cool. And, you know, but he can play the guitar. So what if he said the oboe?
Well, you know, he can come round and I'll try and help him out. Maybe I'll bring it to his studio if it's acoustically treated.
Have you been to Blackburn?
No, I haven't.
Oh,
I've seen lots of pictures and I know. I need to make that happen. I've definitely been invited and it just hasn't happened yet, but it will. Like your interview. We'll make it happen.
Hey, look, this has been so lovely. Thank you so much. Good luck with whatever comes next. Look forward to seeing whatever comes next and all the stuff, the Disney thing. I'm going to look for all the credits, obviously, from here on in. and yeah, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. That was lovely. Thank you.
My thanks once again to Fiona Cruikshank for joining me on this podcast. You are going to listen to Fat Pop and On Sunset completely differently from here on in, right? Being transported to that magnificent Church Studios, imagining Hannah Peel, Stan Kybert, Paul Weller behind the mixing desk in the room with a para orchestra and Fee at the controls. Love it. Do check out the show notes for this podcast. You'll find loads of details on some of the things that we talked about on my website. PaulWellerFanPodcast.com is the place to go. Spread the word. Please do share this episode on your social media channels. It all helps us to find new listeners to the show. And I should say, once you're on my website as well, if you fancy it, you can dive into our store, get yourself some official podcast merchandise or a virtual coffee doing exactly that. Mike Steer. Hello, Mike. Hello to Ron, who says, great show and super guests. Thank you, Ron. Cheers to you for your virtual coffee. Hello to the 829 Club. Thanks for your support, as always. Hello to Jen. Hello to Jez Hawk, who says, grab yourself a proper frothy at Bar Italia and keep up the great work. Thank you, Jez, and thank you so much for your generosity, my friend. Hello to Stephen Cartwright. Hi, Stu Burns. Thank you to you as well. Hello, Jane, the jam tart with a heart. Hello, Jane. Hope you're well. Hello to Nick Keane. Hi, Nick. Hello, Roger Clark. Thanks to you for your virtual coffee. Hi also to Sean Wilson. Thanks, mate. Much appreciated. If you want to get involved next week, make sure you head to my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. Just head into the store there. And whilst you're on the website, make sure you sign up for the newsletter, you follow, you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts as well. On the very next episode, we're going to be talking about merchandise, the Jam, the Style Council, Paul Weller solo, and a massive, massive fan of all three. Make sure you join me. You can get in touch on Twitter at WellerFanPod or on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads. Just search for Paul Weller Fan Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.